Our special guest this morning is someone I've looked forward to getting to know as an adult and as a professional. Dr. Erica Robelin is a family medicine practitioner based in Hamilton, having received her MD from the Michael G. DeGroote School of Medicine in 2013 and completing her residency in family medicine at McMaster University in 2015. Erica has graduated from four schools, including Oakville Christian School and King's Christian Collegiate, receiving first-class honors and being elected valedictorian at all four, including McMaster's prestigious Arts and Science program. She has served as the acting director of Hamilton's Shelter Health Network, where she continues to work, supporting patients experiencing homelessness. She was instrumental in establishing an overdose prevention site in Hamilton and has strongly advocated for safe injection sites. Passionate about providing health care to Indigenous, under-resourced, and new Canadians, Erica's strong Christian faith is foundational in her practice of medicine. Erica converted to Orthodoxy in her late 20s and is a member of the St. Maria of Paris Orthodox Mission in Hamilton. She's currently pursuing a Master's of Theological Studies through Trinity College at the University of Toronto. An accomplished pianist, an avid cyclist and trekker, an adventurous international traveler, and a voracious reader, I'm exhausted for her. Well, Erica, someone special did manage to catch up to you. You're engaged.
It's true. Yes, I am.
Tell us, what's the plan and who's the man?
Well, the plan is we hope to be married next summer in June. That's the date that we've set. His name is Gajan. And of course, right now, there's a lot of uncertainty and we don't know exactly what that will look like. But we have committed to getting married June 27th, no matter what.
And what is your fiancé's profession?
He is a professor of economics. He works at McMaster University in Hamilton.
Do you think you might have to cut back on one or two things you've been very busy about?
Yeah, you know, I am so grateful that his work is actually remarkably flexible. And so I feel like he can pick up a lot of my slack sometimes. And, you know, he'll be more flexible with the cooking and the errands and things like that. So it's great.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, our paths crossed for years at Chartwell Baptist Church in Oakville, where at the time your dad, Peter Robelin, was pastoring. And I can't help but wonder, did that little girl that I saw then want to be a doctor?
You know, medicine was definitely something I thought about in high school, I would say. I don't know. I don't have memories of when I was really little thinking about wanting to pursue medicine. But certainly in high school, you know, I think I fell into that that sort of pattern where you do well in school, you do well in science, and people sort of encourage you to go towards medicine. Maybe you could be a doctor. So I think that was in the back of my mind in high school and when I entered university. But actually being in university, things really changed for me, and I was much more interested in philosophy and literature and studying the humanities. And so that's where my focus was actually in my undergrad. And it was only near the end of my 5 years of study that I thought, you know, I don't know if I can live in books for the rest of my life. And I really felt a draw to do something more embodied, a little more hands-on, more practical. And so it was at that point that I sort of turned back to medicine as something that was, yeah, felt right.
Interesting. You know, in our local church history at Chartwell, in those days, we had an unusual number of untimely deaths. It really impacted your dad to the extent that he wrote a book about the journey, his faith journey through the loss of friends and church members. The book is entitled Mercy, Life in the Season of Dying. Did any of that impact your choices, your worldview, what you're doing now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it did. I think that that environment growing up where, you know, death was just a reality that we knew about and it was something that we experienced through the relationships my father formed with these families, there was never any illusion that we were immortal. You know, mm-hmm. death was a present reality, and grief was something that we talked about and explored, I think, as a family.
Wonderful.
At different points. And absolutely, this has impacted my journey in medicine and my career in medicine. You know, I think Western medicine likes to present itself as being able to offer immortality. Mm. Maybe not in those words, but a lot of the other language we use and things we offer, you know, sort of put forth this facade that we can put off death forever. And a lot of people are really uncomfortable thinking about their own mortality, their own potential, you know, and inevitable death at some point.
And no, I think false illusions for you.
That's right. And I think doctors, as a result of that, feel a discomfort with discussing death as well with their patients. So, you know, I think that early exposure in my life has helped me to be able to speak with patients about it.
Well, I just look at your career path. I mean, beyond your practice of 5 years, you're involved with people battling addictions, under-resourced people, people with overwhelming needs, not all of which you can fix.
Yeah.
How do you cope with the injustice and the potential overwhelm that you're seeing on a regular basis?
Yeah, I think, you know, anyone in medicine, anyone in some of these, you know, first line jobs where you're encountering people with a lot of needs, a lot of history of trauma, you know, we're all at risk of burnout for sure. And I think that we can be overwhelmed with the needs that we see in front of us. For me, I know that my faith has been a really important part of how I deal with this. You know, I think as Christians, we're sort of, we have this complex tension where we know that the world is not as it should be. There's brokenness, and we are complicit in that, right? There's this web of fallenness and brokenness, and we're part of it, and our patients are part of it. And there's this urgent sense that this is not the way the world should be. You know, we want it to be different. And there we have our drive to, you know, work for justice for our patients and, you know, the activism side of things. And at the same time, we can feel like our efforts only go so far, right? And that can be really discouraging. I think for me, sometimes taking a step back and looking at the trajectory of where we know the world and we know that history is going as Christians, we believe that, you know, God has already brought his salvific work to this earth, and this is the trajectory we're on. God is redeeming, God is making all things new, he's bringing life, and we're called to participate in that. And I think when I frame it that way, I feel more hopeful and feel like, okay, I can get caught up in that, and it's not all on my shoulders.
We know the end of the story.
Yeah.
Erica, what motivated you to move into something so challenging?
You know, I think it was really the direct teaching of Christ and the gospel that has led me to want to work with the poor, with the marginalized. You know, Christ taught us that the kingdom belongs to the least of these, to the poor, to the brokenhearted, to the oppressed. And he's also taught us that the kingdom will not be easy to enter for those of us who are privileged, those of us who are wealthy. So in some ways, I feel like as a person who does have a lot of privilege, I need to align myself with the poor, with the needy. They're teaching me what the kingdom of God looks like. And I feel like I am learning what it looks like to love the way Christ wants us to love through my work with those patients.
You know, years of doing interviews, people who work with those who are homeless say the same thing.
Yeah.
The presence of Christ in the hardest places.
Yeah.
And in those people.
It's there in a real way. There is something really remarkable. And I mean, there's lots of practical ways I see this borne out. I see examples of resilience, examples of people willing to trust, although they've been given no reason to trust anyone in the past. Just generosity, holding the things of this world with an open hand, you know. Though they might not have much, you know, have been so quick to give. I have a patient who gifted me her watch the other week because she thought it looked like it would go with my outfit and I should have it. So there's just these precious examples that come up so often that, I learn a lot from. I'm very privileged to be able to work with this population.
This brings me to another question, though. as a licensed practitioner, mm-hmm. you can't share Christ mm-hmm. with your patients, mm-hmm. but you are his hands and feet. Mm-hmm. Is that a struggle? How do you experience being God's girl mm-hmm. in these situations?
Yeah, I think the role that has taken for me, I think a lot about my work with the Shelter Health Network, where I'm working with folks who are homeless and who have been marginalized in so many ways, and who often have felt, I think, very disrespected in the healthcare mm-hmm. system and not treated well. And to show them, I think, just simple respect and dignity as people and as the image bearers of Christ that they are, I think that to me goes a long way. People often ask me, is it very difficult working with these patients? And that has not been my experience. I have actually found it very life-giving and very easy, sometimes easier than my other practice in certain ways. Yeah. Certainly it comes with other challenges, but yeah, I think that to be the hands and feet of Christ to those people doesn't necessarily take words or take, preaching the gospel message, but just being kind and treating them with love and respect, and that seems to go a long way.
What's the place of prayer in your life and practice, Erica?
Prayer for me, I have a prayer rule that I follow, so that looks like, morning prayers and evening prayers, prayers before meals, so sort of that five times a day structure of prayer, which I try to follow to the best of my ability, sometimes with more diligence than other times. But that is very grounding for me, staying in that kind of a routine. As it relates to my practice, I think, to go back to your earlier question about when I feel sometimes overwhelmed by the needs that I'm presented mm-hmm. with, and certainly all of the difficulties that patients might be experiencing that I cannot address in 1,000 years. Sometimes to bring those patients, very specifically, I bring them in prayer before God.
Just to ask, do what only He can do.
Yeah,
Lord,
have mercy.
That's how I pray sometimes. Lord, yeah. Do what only You can do.
Yeah. And that to me sometimes feels like the most valuable thing I could probably do for that patient. And again, sometimes just helps me to remember that it's not all about me, it's not all about the work that I do, but it's about someone else doing important work.
Wonderful, wonderful. God's word must mean a lot to you. Mm. You're pursuing a master's in theology.
Mm-hmm. I am.
What do you want to do with that?
It's a good question. I think, it's really been for personal growth and development that I have been pursuing this. So I'm doing, the master's in theological studies at U of T right now in a very part-time way. So it's very slow. But for me, I think in medicine, the practice of medicine, the experience of being with patients who are sick and suffering has brought up so many questions that medicine does not have answers to. Uh-huh. Questions of chronic pain, questions of all sorts of different things about suffering. To me, it makes me want to interrogate those aspects of the human experience in ways other than, the scientific method, I suppose. So to me, studying theology and the church's approach to some of these different issues has been really rewarding and actually informative, I think, to my practice, not always in a direct way. But I do think that both things actually inform each other. It's
very interesting. Mm-hmm. Medicine is both a science and an art.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone in your field acknowledges the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
How are things collegially for someone who's so open about her faith?
Mm-hmm. I think coming into medical school, I sort of had this sense that it might be a bit of a battlefield, or I might have to be very close-lipped about my faith mm-hmm. or cautious about that. And I think I've been really pleasantly surprised to actually not feel that way. There are so many people of faith in the world of medicine, not just Christian faith, but also Muslim faith, Jewish faith, obviously, everything under the sun. And in my medical school class, it was often my Muslim classmates that really inspired me in the way that they were living and pursuing the study of medicine. And now in my practice, I share a practice with a colleague who's Baha'i, and we have many, many interesting conversations about our faith. So, you know, I guess I've been grateful to have come across many colleagues who are also people of faith, even if they're not all Christians. And I think that there's lots that we share together about, you know, difficulties that come up with our practice that for us, our faith is really important to answer.
Yeah. Wonderful. Do you have a life verse?
A life verse?
A specific verse that has been kind of a marker for you, a go-to?
That's a good question. I don't know that I could not point to one specific verse. I think, you know, one thing that I alluded to a little bit before, but just this idea of, you know, that Christ and God's work through the incarnation is making all things new. And I think as I encounter sickness and death and, you know, things that actually don't look like that in my day-to-day life and practice, that is certainly a verse and a truth that I do go back to.
Motivating.
And, yeah, yeah.
That gives hope where there doesn't seem to be a lot.
Yeah, that's true.
Love that. So true. Okay. Mm-hmm. The elephant in the room, COVID-19, the largest health crisis the world has seen in a century and, and our lifetime. Well, how has this affected you in your practice? Let's start there.
Sure. You know, very practically speaking, my practice looks different now. I'm not seeing all my patients in person. I can't always them. I can't always examine them in the ways that I'm used to, so we're doing a lot more virtual care.
You're not a big fan of that.
Whether it's phone or video, no, I'm not. You know, I think that, I mean, of course, as a medical professional, I wasn't trained to practice that way, so it, you know, leads to all sorts of problems and questions that way. But also, I think this is something that we've all experienced as so many of our activities or work have moved into a digital platform. You know, we are incarnate human beings. We were made to be embodied and in each other's embodied presence. And it is not the same when we're just looking at each other on a screen. Even if we feel like we can accomplish the same work, the way that that work feels is not the same. And I think a lot of the therapeutic benefit of an appointment with your doctor is lost when it's
absolutely
over video or telephone. So
and I just share a study here, just one, 1,200 people of diverse cultures and ethnicities found that the study found that being lonely increases the risk of Alzheimer's by 40%. The longer one is lonely, the greater the health risks at any age. And 8 million people in the U.S. over the age of 50 identify as chronically lonely.
Yeah.
I was sharing with you about a friend who was shocked when her Bible study group, the women came together, the physical decline from just too long being isolated, too long without face-to-face contact. Yeah. We need it like air and water.
Yes, we do.
You're seeing this, Erica, in your own patients.
Yes, I've seen this in many of my patients who I've spoken to, and you know, I can think specifically about a couple of different elderly women in my practice who have told me that their lives have just been taken away from them, their regular contact with their children, their grandchildren, really the things that they lived for and that gave them vitality have all been removed as people try to, you know, maintain social distancing and all these things that we've been asked to do that are so difficult. But it's, you know, literally taking their life from them to be alone in this way for such a prolonged period of time. Yeah.
It's interesting to hear from medical people that the concern that bubbles to the surface is social-emotional.
Yeah.
Not viral infection,
yeah,
but the social-emotional component.
I mean, I think that's right, and I think that's a lot of what we're seeing in family practices, in a lot of my colleagues are psychiatrists and psychiatric practices. You know, I think this has been a challenging time, and I think, of course, our public health officials and government officials are doing their absolute best to come up with, you know, guidelines and solutions to keep us as safe as possible. At the same time, I think as physicians, you know, we took an oath when we went into training to do no harm.
Yes.
And I think we really have to think hard about the harms that these measures are also going to do, which might not be as easy to quantify as you know, number of infections or a death count or anything like that, but are still real harms. And like so much of medicine, we have to be weighing the risks and benefits of any given treatment that we propose. So this is certainly something that I know I'm thinking about, many of my colleagues are thinking about. I know there's been many op-eds published and things about physicians who are concerned about the social effects and emotional effects, as you said, of a prolonged lockdown like this. Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking of your life journey, what I know of it, and some of your educational choices that weren't purely on that science path. Mm-hmm. Now dealing with people who are frustrated, grieving. Mm-hmm. Everybody has loss on some level because of this health crisis. I know you have sensitivity to the whole person, and hopefully time with those patients to respond to those unusual needs.
That's right. Yes, I think a lot of my encounters lately have been a listening ear, and there's not a lot else that I can offer, which also feels challenging as a physician. You want to do something, you want to offer solutions, but it's certainly a practice in humility, right? When we just don't know. You know, I think that's the other thing that COVID has brought up is just our fear of uncertainty, which I see so often in my family practice, not related to COVID, but you know, we're all creatures who crave final answers, definitive answers. Patients want to know, are they going to get cancer? What was that pain in their chest? You know, answers are what we want. And with COVID, we want to know, what can I do to keep myself and my family safe? What can I do to, you know, prevent the spread of this illness? All these things. And this is such a situation of uncertainty, and we don't know. And I think as people of faith, hopefully, we're people who are well equipped to sit with that uncertainty and to...
We'll keep moving forward.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, this is just a little selfish. Last question. Roughly 1 million Ontarians do not have a family doctor. Access to primary care is a struggle for many. Mm-hmm. My daughter in Ottawa, it has been on a waiting list for some time.
Yeah.
Any hope for the future in this department? Are people pouring into medical studies? Are we going to be able to resolve this, do you think, in the near future?
It's a good question, and it's hard to say because it is, it's a geographically inequitable problem, right? There are some communities and cities that are actually saturated with family doctors and have enough to serve the population that's there.
And I'm happy for them.
Yeah, which is wonderful. And that's what we would hope for the whole province. But of course, you know, to recruit a physician to work in Moose Factory on James Bay and to stay there is very, very challenging. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, the province has recruitment programs and things like this to help guide and push new family physicians into these, you know, at-need areas. But at the end of the day, it's where doctors want to live, which, you know, doesn't always span the whole province. So there, you know, there is push to get more medical students pursuing family medicine as opposed to some different specialties. Yeah, we'll just have to wait and see.
Okay, Dr. Roblin, we've learned you're a voracious reader. Mm-hmm. So everyone, I'm sure, is wondering, what would you recommend right now? Do you have we can't do a top 10, but one or two?
I have a book that I would recommend really to anyone. It's called Reclaiming the Body. And it is a book that was really influential for me, actually, in my first year of medical school. It's about the faithful use of modern medicine for Christians. And it's not just for medical practitioners, it's really for anyone who will find themselves interacting with the medical system, which is probably all of us at some point in our lives. And, you know, it helps us to reframe things. Medicine in our society has so much authority and so much power. And it helps to just shift the perspective so that we are approaching medicine through our lens of faith, rather than having, you know, this modern medical system influence our faith in the other way, if that makes sense. It's a really good read. It's written, there's co-authors, a theologian and a physician. Joel Schumann and Brian Volk are the names of the authors, and I would highly recommend it.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, we can say, I'm sure I speak for everyone who participates here this morning. We're so thankful God called you, Dr. Erica Robelin, to this field for such a time as this. Mm-hmm. Frustrating as it is even for you practicing, we're glad that you are. And thank you. We're proud of you. Mm-hmm. And we pray God will guard you as the apple of his eye. So good to see you all grown up serving God and this country in such a wonderful way. Bless you.
Thank you, Moira.